This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Back Gardening. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb. Great day to be out in the garden and so much to do and so much happening.
Oh, there is. It's outrageous October. There are garden shows everywhere. And if you want an excuse to get out in the garden, then all you have to do is get out there. Give Sophie a call if you'd like some advice on 1300 222 891. We'll have a brief chat about the appeal of geraniums and pelargoniums. It never goes away, does it?
No, and I've just been showing a group of interstaters around Kangaroo Island, and one of the things they have all been admiring is the incredible displays of them. So, you know, it's something we take for granted in South Australia, but geraniums and pelargoniums are an amazing addition to any garden.
They certainly are, and they bring lots of colour at this time of year. We'll have a brief chat about that and about dahlias as well, but we welcome your calls on 1300 222 891. I have a couple of ABC Gardener magazines to give away a little bit later in the program as well. But let's get into your calls. Lou in Parkholm is joining us. Now, Lou, you have a plum tree infestation. Good morning.
Good morning, Deb and Sophie. Yes, I have an 8-year-old Satsuma plum tree that's a espaliered, and with a small infestation of leaf curl aphids last year, which I cut off, with a great crop of plums. But this year, about 70%, if not more, of all new shoots and leaves have been infected by the leaf curl aphids, and I think I can say goodbye to my fruit this year. But what can I do to the tree? Will it survive the summer?
Absolutely. So the most important thing is you need to nurture your tree in terms of water and also in terms of, you know, seaweed-based plantronics and fertilizer, because those leaves that are affected will drop off and new leaves will come. So you've got to support your tree to put on a second crop of leaves. But the thing I would say is that last weekend I was in a community garden and we actually got to demonstrate this. There were two trees. One had a touch of the aphids on it and one was absolutely smothered. Now, the one that was absolutely smothered really had nothing around it to bring in beneficial bugs that will help you. And yet the one that had a touch of it had things like calendulas growing near it, had some daisies, had some parsley, because basically what happens is the good bugs will clean up the bad, but the good bugs come in for nectar and pollen. So having a bit more diversity around fruit trees can make a huge difference. And the other thing to do is, when you treat with an insecticide, so we've got ladybirds, lacewings and hoverflies that will all deal with the aphids. Then we've also got a parasitic wasp that parasitizes the aphid, and you're left with these pale brown, shiny cocoons. They're basically aphid mummies. Now, as soon as we use proper insecticides, we kill all those guys. So when you can, if the situation isn't so bad, just squirting all the aphids off for a couple of weeks, right? So when you squirt the aphids off, a new crop will come back tomorrow or in a couple of days. So you keep doing it for a couple of weeks, and that gives the beneficials long enough to build up in numbers to manage them. Now, another thing I did see people doing in this community garden is they had gaffer tape turned inside out around the base of the tree, so that when they squirt the aphids off and a new crop starts to come up, they get stuck on the gaffer tape. And the gaffer tape, or you can get proper fruit tree grease band, which is designed for it. The gaffer tape was black with aphids. It was almost a scene from a horror movie. Try and squirt the aphids off if there's still some fresh ones there. And rather than use an insecticide, really try and encourage the beneficials. And, you know, in current market gardens and community gardens, I would say about a third, or this is organic things, a third are planted up with flowers that will bring in the good bugs. And if you've never grown them before, go to your, you know, local outlet and they will have a packet of beneficial bug mix seeds. And that will include parsley and Queen Anne's lace and maybe dill and coriander. And then it will include things like calendulas and alyssum. And all those guys bring in the good bugs, and the good bugs will help you manage the bad for future years. So
I've got huge, huge parsley plants coming into flower now, and I've got dills as well. So just leave those. I was going to actually throw them out because they went to seed.
I'll
leave them in there.
So leave them in, but also bring in some calendulas. You know, they're the beautiful, bright, bright orange daisy flowers. The petals are edible, and they will, and even let them self-seed under your fruit trees. You know, we often have nothing under our fruit trees, but we need to get the beneficials in. And just another random one, if you've got the space, even any type of salt bush near fruit trees, salt bush bring in beneficials, and also they bring in a lot of the parasitoids, which are the beneficials we want to parasitize the aphids. So I know last week in the community garden we were looking everywhere and we did find the parasitoids. So we want to get more of those happening in your garden. So calendulas for the beneficials, and also even a type of salt bush, and it can be a dwarf salt bush.
Just aside for that bit, underneath the plum tree, there are a blanket of dichondra. Is that a hindrance or is it a problem?
No, it's not a problem at all. You know, the calendula will self-seed around that.
Thank you, Lou. I hope it all goes well. And just another reason to love gaffer tape right there. Now, Angela from Clare would like some advice for plants in a rock garden. Welcome, Angela.
Yes, good morning. I have a raised rock garden that goes alongside the veranda, which is facing south, so that in winter it's just full shade and in summer it gets a lot of strong sun. So I was just hoping, Sophie, you might be able to suggest some plants I could use in that space.
Okay, what sort of things are you wanting? You know, how tall are you wanting? Are you wanting, you know, evergreens? Are you wanting flowers that you can pick, or...?
I am wanting whatever will grow in that space, preferably no higher than about 500-600 centimetres. Mm-hmm. It's a narrow space, but it's a long space. It's in two sections. It's raised in one section for about 2-3 feet, and then the other section that's a little bit lower is another foot and a half. And it runs the length of the veranda, so it's long and narrow in spaces. So whatever will do well in that space. Evergreen would be lovely.
Okay, and are you wanting just one plant as a hedge, or are you wanting different things for interest?
Different things, yes.
Okay,
It's a visual impact as you're sort of driving towards a house. It's quite a visual impact. So I really would like it, if it's possible, to have flowering, perhaps stuff that flowers in summer and dies off in winter, and then other things that do well in winter and dies off in summer, or something like that. I really don't know.
Okay, so some of the plants I'm going to suggest are really hardy, and, you know, there'll probably be some listeners rolling their eyes, but we want some hardy things. One of them is Nandina nana, you know, which is the dwarf sacred bamboo. You know, it will take full shade. It'll take full sun. You get the beautiful autumnal colours from it, and there are the different forms now that have the more lacy forms. They're actually basically dwarf forms of the tall Nandina. So Nandina is tough as old boots. Another plant that's tough as old boots is Raffia lepus or Indian hawthorn. Now, they are really tough. Again, they'll take full sun, they'll take full shade. They flower in springtime, and they flower either with pink or white flowers, and they're just a lovely, strong form. I would start to try and put some strappy leaf plants in there too, just because I like the contrast of the strappy. Now, because it's full sun, I would be looking at native strappy leaf plants, and some of those things like Lamandra tanica, which is quite interesting, fine foliage, great form. There's others called Lime Tuff, and TUFF, that is. And so some of those to break up the other forms. And then I'd be trying some things like Alstroemeria. Now, Alstroemeria are amazing plants, but there are some dwarf forms, and they call them princess lilies. Now, I love plants I can pick. And can I tell you, you know, out in the desert, I've taken these pots of Alstroemeria out there, and they haven't skipped a beat. They flower less in the cooler weather, so that won't matter. They don't get sun, and they only get to about 15 centimetres high, 20 centimetres high, and they have beautiful different coloured flowers, and they form a clump. So that'll be a bit of bling, if you like. Mm-hmm. You know, you set up your framework of plants you can rely on, and then a bit of bling. I think, you know, you'll have lots of fun in that area. I mean, there are some good garden centres in Clare, and there's some great staff that work there that have great knowledge. So, you know, I'd be heading along, say you want some of these things. The most important thing is to work out how many metres you're filling and how wide. And if you take that space, the staff at the nursery or garden centre will help you work out what you need in terms of numbers.
Fantastic. That's some great ideas. Thank you very much for that. And I like the variety that you're suggesting as well with the different plants and the strappy plants. That sounds really good.
I think mixing it up is beautiful.
Yes, will the Lamandra do all right in full shade through winter?
Absolutely. Ultimately, there's not as much sun in winter anyway. So it's going to be fine. I mean, they're really hard. They're a bit of a, what will I call them, a municipal plant, which means that councils use them a lot. And sometimes we roll our eyes because of that. You know, they're really tough and gorgeous form.
Enjoy that project, Angela. Sounds like fun. Thanks very much. 1-300-222-891 is the phone number. On the text line, Sophie, some lovely texts. Clint says, is there anything gaffer tape can't fix? Whatever that is, it can be fixed with zip ties. Clint, I'm part of your tribe for sure. Barbara says, nasturtium plants around roses and fruit trees completely protect from aphids from my experience. I've actually got nasturtiums under my roses. I do get a few aphids, but not very many. So I think, you know, Barbara might be onto something there. And Kelly from Murrum Bateman in New South Wales says, loving all this rich info that Sophie is sharing about encouraging beneficials. Great show, Sophie. So thank you, Kelly, for listening in New South Wales. And there's a beautiful photograph being sent through. You can't see it, but it's a beneficial bee enjoying the pop-up rocket. Says anything with wings is loving the yellow flowers. And that's from Emily in Port Augusta. And she can't wait.
Oh, go, Emily.
Yeah, she can't wait for the bee to talk at the Kwandong Festival today, so you may well meet Emily today, I'm sure.
I will. I know her well.
And Gillian says, any tips to prevent I'll come back to that, Gillian. Debbie says, lovely pelargoniums and geraniums at Murray Bridge, and has sent a beautiful picture through. And they are just incredibly popular and have been so for as long as I can remember. Certainly in my childhood, every garden had a geranium or a pelargonium, and that was something that your recent visitors commented on Kangaroo Island, Sophie.
Absolutely. You know, geraniums and pelargoniums, some people sort of have forgotten how extraordinary these plants are in really tough conditions. They survive and they thrive and they perform year after year, and they give you so much colour. And so I had a group of interstaters, and we were visiting some of the gardens on KI, which have quite tough conditions, and people just were taking photos of these amazing plants and things like ivy geraniums growing over a fence. Now, it used to be something of our childhood. There are some strobe poles in Adelaide that have got ivy geraniums growing, you know, 3 metres up them and looking incredible. So I think we should celebrate this amazing group of plants. And to tell us more about them, we've got Jocelyn Powell, a committee member from the South Australian Geranium and Pelargonium Society. Hello, Jocelyn.
Hello, Sophie. Good morning and thank you for having me.
So geraniums and pelargoniums are one of those hardy plants that sometimes we just take for granted. You know, I moved into a property that was abandoned in the desert, let's say, abandoned for 4 years, and I get there and they're still flowering. You know, they're amazing.
They are indeed. They're absolutely stunning, and the variety of pelargoniums that you can get are just, it's just amazing these days.
Now, there's a little bit of confusion about pelargoniums and geraniums because that's always a grey area. So just clarify that briefly for us.
Okay, so this goes back a few hundred years when pelargoniums were first observed, and they tried to categorise them into the gardening and into the families and the different genus and those sorts of things. This is going back as far as Linnaeus when he did all of his nomenclature. But when they looked at the flower and they looked at the leaf, they thought that they should be with, they thought they were within another, or very, very closely related to, cranes bills, which are the hardy geraniums. They're a true they're a geranium. So there's a family, the Geraniaceae family, and hardy geraniums are one of those genus. But about 20 years after they first classified them, they said, no, there are enough differences, we'll create them their own genus. So pelargoniums are separate from geraniums. They are, but within the same family. What we think of as geraniums in our garden would be a zonal pelargonium. Mm-hmm. So there are very few true geraniums that would be growing in South Australia, for example, because it's too hot. They're a maritime climate type plant. They're what's called a hardy geranium, or hardy, they're a hardy perennial. They die back in the winter. They come back. They're what you would see in gardens in England, for example, or possibly up in colder climates within Australia. What we see on the plains and in the outback are pelargoniums. So we've got zonal pelargoniums. They're the ones that we think of, the reds and the oranges, and a variety of other different colours as well. We've got ivy pelargoniums. They're our cascading, smaller leaf, a little bit more waxy pelargonium. We've got regals, which are correctly named as regal pelargoniums. And then you've got a variety of others. So within the family of Geraniaceae, we've got geraniums, and they are distinctly different as to how they look and how they grow and the best climate for them. And what we have in Australia, 99% of it would be a pelargonium.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and if people sort of are still slightly confused, don't worry about it. Go along to the geranium and pelargonium show and you will see what you're expecting to see. And they are absolutely amazing. Now, there will be all sorts of displays of different sizes of, you know, blooms, because their blooms vary in size quite a bit too, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, so as you enter, we're at the Western Youth Centre on Marion Road at Cowandilla from 9:30 this morning. And as you enter, there's a room off to the left and we have display plants. And these are large, mature, good examples of all the different pelargoniums that we have here. We've got some amazing coloured leaf ones. We've got ivies. We've got regals. We've got a whole display of all the different flowers you can get. Some of them, the zonals are, some of the blooms are huge.
But while we've got you, Jocelyn, Sandra from Hackham has phoned in with a geranium question. You might be able to help us with your expertise here. Good morning, Sandra.
Oh, good morning, everyone. A friend has just bought a trailing geranium, which has the typical leaf. It's dark and it's got a beautiful purple flower. And I'm just wondering, to train it, do they, trailing ones, do they normally just go sideways, or can you train them up? And often Sophie mentions when you're trailing something up, you don't go for height, you go across.
Great question, Sandra.
Yeah, so, fantastic.
They grow beautifully growing up, don't they? And they just naturally grow up, Jocelyn. If you might need to tie them to get them started, but they naturally grow up.
Yeah, so they will reach towards the sun, and so they do grow up nicely. They also will cover sideways. They're not like you would think of as a, like an English ivy where they can actually attach to anything. So often they do need support. So that might be a trellis type system. It could be something as simple as wire netting, something that will support them as they grow up. And you can, as you said before, Sophie, grow them up stoby poles, over fences, up a variety of trellises. The ivies that I have, ivy pelargoniums, I've got most of mine in baskets. But if I put them in the ground, they would spread and grow up like a mound as well. So you do need to support them, but you can train them, and that's all about pruning. So we generally prune for shape and to get cuttings once a year, but then you can tip prune them and tidy them at pretty much any time of the year.
There you go, Sandra. Sounds easy.
Oh, yeah, and just grow them. grow them straight up. You don't need to worry about doing that sideways trick. That's for other climbers. So
that's great. Thanks, Sandra. And this texter says, great explanation, re geraniums and pelargoniums. I've spent years wondering why my geraniums are different from the ones I grew up with in my parents' garden in the UK. So, Jocelyn Powell, thanks so much for talking pelargoniums and geraniums with us this morning. We appreciate your time.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
And Deb, can I just add, there are actually, just to make it even more confusing, there are some true geraniums in Australian native plants too. So I've actually just been planting them because they would have been part of the natural flora out where I am. And they're sort of feeble little, or not feeble, they're very tough, but they're delicate little things. So, you know, if someone's listening and going, oh, I thought there were some Australian native geraniums, there certainly are, and they're quite beautiful.
Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson Talk Back Gardening. We'll come back to your calls next on 1300 222 891.
This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson
on 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Time now to speak to John from Paynham. Now, John, you've got a metal raised garden bed. I can already hear what Sophie's going to say. Good morning.
Yes, yes. I'm part of a group who are doing a community garden at the Lutheran Retirement Village. And we've got these, I think they call them birdie beds or something, but they're fairly high, about 70 or 80 centimetres high, and we don't want to put real good soil all that way up. So what's the best way to fill them up?
Okay, so great question. I'm going to go back a step. I'm not a fan of metal raised beds because of the radiant heat, okay? Yes. So if you touch, you can't put your hand on a corrugated iron fence when it's 40 degrees, right? Yes. And yet the plant's roots are right behind that. You know, plant roots die when the soil temperature gets in the mid-40s. So it means that, you know, it stresses the plant and you get sunburn and everything like that. Having said that, if that's what you've got, how can you make it better? Yeah. Then I would be trying to find some sort of insulation you can put on the inside of the bed. Okay. Now, you can get even Corflute, which is that plasticated, you know, sort of cardboard type structure, even sheets of that on the inside of the bed would make a difference. And someone else I know put the roll of sort of insulation that's a few mils thick, and they put that on the inside of the bed. So that's the first thing. Now, the second thing is, if you spoke to community gardens around South Australia, most of them would have wicking beds, not plain raised beds, because wicking beds are much more efficient on water. Now, you could retrofit what you've got and make them into wicking beds, but there's going to be a bit of fiddling around. But if you go, do you know what, we're just going to do it as it is, and if it doesn't work, we'll redo it later. What I would then do is get bales of straw or hay, jam in the bottom. Now, if you want really tightly packed bales, and you put them in the bottom of the bed, and that will take up about 30 centimetres. And that then leaves you with just the top 30 centimetres, which you add the best soil you can get, the best veggie garden soil you can get. You only need about 30 centimetres. Now, what happens over time is the straw or hay in the bottom of the bed breaks down, but over the course of a year, it'll only break down about 5 to 10 centimetres. So when you're topping your beds up and you're putting in new crops, you add more compost. So putting bales in the bottom is the cheat's way of filling it. But do look at how you can insulate because, you know, it's certainly easier to grow in wicking beds and in beds that are wooden rather than metal. And bear in mind, these metal beds, they're, you know, many of them are made in the eastern states. Well, in the eastern states, they haven't got our heat. So,
Yes, we have our finances restricted, as I guess.
Still, you don't want to spend all that money on plants, John, and then have them die in the heat. So
that's what I agree.
So maybe take that one back to the group and have a chat about it.
And work on insulation.
Thanks, John, for calling in, and good luck with whatever you decide to do there. Now, dahlias, they were very old-fashioned. That's how they were considered. But they've become really popular in current years. And joining us now is Neville Jeschke, who's president of the Dahlia Society of South Australia. Good morning, Neville.
Good morning, Deb and Sophie and listeners.
Now, with what do you owe the popularity of dahlias these days?
I think people have been attracted to them through social media, through our shows, through promotions, but it's almost a worldwide phenomenon from what I can gather. It's certainly here in Australia has become a very popular flower. People just fall in love with them and, away it goes.
They do, and they've really fallen in love with them because they make such an amazing cut flower. So, you know, a vase of dahlias in someone's house is going to look spectacular. And so really it's the influences that have made people remember, because I remember as a child my parents had florist shops and I remember selling bunches of dahlias and they were just as beautiful then, but people have rediscovered these amazing plants.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I remember as a child, the dahlia was quite the common garden flower. And in those days when you visited someone, the first thing you did was look at the gardens and there was always dahlias there. And that's actually how I got involved with dahlias, was through my mum, who grew some and we inherited them. And through growing them and experiencing the joy and of the broad range of types that are available and bunching and selling or giving away, the joy that it gives other people is just amazing.
Absolutely. And they flower in summertime. So here we are in late spring and people mightn't think that, you know, because one of the things, they are a true tuber, so they die right down to nothing. So we're here in late spring and people mightn't think, you know, that they need to do anything with them, but you certainly can at the moment, can't you?
Well, this is the beginning of the life cycle of the dahlia plant. They've been dormant and now they're coming to life. Those that are tubers that we have in storage are now shooting, have got eyes on it, and some have developed shoots 10 centimetres long. When it's time to also take green cuttings, if you like to do that. And so it's now time to acquire your dahlia tubers and get them in the ground so that you'll have blooms by the end of January. And they actually do come into their best in autumn. That's when they really get into their best flowering time.
Okay, now I have one quick question, Neville, and it's a rather random one. Is it dahlia or is it dahlia?
We generally in Australia say dahlia.
Isn't it interesting? I hear people say dahlia and I thought, well, I wonder which one's right.
we still use dahlia.
Okay. Yep, beautiful. Well, that's nice to know. Thanks for sorting that one out for us. And someone on the text line says, there's a great popularity of the dark-coloured leaf dahlias for the home garden. So if you want to get some, today is the day. It's the time to be putting them in. And you can head along to the Dahlia Society of South Australia open tuber sale tomorrow. Sorry, when I say today's the day, tomorrow is actually the day, at the Goodman Lecture Theatre at the Adelaide Botanic Gardens from 2 until 3:30. Neville will be there to answer your questions. Thanks for joining us, Neville. Always a pleasure to hear about the Dahlia Society.
You're most welcome and thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks very much. We are continuing Talkback Gardening. Your phone line to get on to Sophie and get some great advice is 1300 222 891.
This is Talkback Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talkback Gardening, and all the way from Quorn, good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb. Good morning, listeners.
What a fantastic weekend for gardening. If you've got a question for Sophie, please do call in now on 1300 222 891. And I have a couple of ABC gardening magazines to give away a little later, one by phone, one by text, if you'd like to get ready for that, on 0467922891. We love your comments. Sophie, Pam from St. Clair has sent through a beautiful picture of, I don't know if it's geraniums or pelargoniums, absolutely stunning, that we spoke about earlier. We've spoken about all sorts of flowers this morning. Christy says, I thought I'd send in a photo of my geraniums, my mum's favourite flower. Cut a bunch to put in my kitchen yesterday to think of her. That's lovely, Christy, and a beautiful plant that you've got there as well. Anna has sent through pictures of her gorgeous dahlias last year. And Louise says, dahlias are named after the 18th century Swedish botanist Anders Dahl, a student of Carl Linnaeus. Pronounce the name the same as Roald Dahl. Therefore, the correct pronunciation is dahlia, not dahlia.
Thank you. There you go. We've got the right botanical nomenclature, pronunciation, I should say.
You learn something new every single day. And I would say that another texter sent through saying that a guest speaker on dahlias was referring them to them as dahlias. So, gee, Barb, we've got a whole range there. But anyway, let's get straight into your questions. Rob is in Salisbury Heights and has a citrus question. Welcome, Rob.
Oh, good morning and thanks for the program. Sophie, I have a dwarf Washington navel, that I want to plant out into a plastic container. The container is probably between 90 and 100 litres. And I've listened to what Ian Tolley says. I want to your advice about, first of all, is my size adequate for a dwarf Washington navel? And secondly, should I plant it straight into that container or should I graduate in through various size containers first?
Oh, interesting. So I think it is suitable for the long term. There are lots of people when you have young plants that tell you to pot them up rather than going too big. But then I always, in my head, I can't justify if the plant's established and it's quite strong, if you plant it out in the ground, that's like having a giant pot, which is obviously oversized for its capacity. So, you know, I would be comfortable if you planted it into that larger pot. But can I say, I would love you to do the Ian Tolley method of planting, which is to bare root your plant. Have you seen that?
I've watched that when you interviewed him and I was shocked. Yeah.
I know. It is quite scary. Yeah, absolutely. We did it with 21 plants, you know, in November at my previous property, and it really does. You wash the soil off. So when you do that at this time of year, you know, if we're having a 35-degree day, I wouldn't be doing it that day. I'd wait till the weather's sort of milder and you wash the soil off. Now, the other thing you must do is you must have a premium potting media, right, because then it's got the correct water drainage capacity and everything like that. How big is your plant at the moment?
It's in a small pot that I've just purchased. It would be something like about 8 or 9 centimetres square, I would say.
Oh, so it's a very tiny plant.
No, it's actually quite tall, amazingly tall for such a small container, actually.
Okay. Well, look, I would definitely wash the soil off while it seems counterintuitive. Do keep – the only other thing with plants in pots is you have to keep the water up to them. And, the rough rule of thumb is, you know, you water them daily. Now, if it's milder, you won't need to. But Ian's trick of touching the leaf and feeling if it's cool is the best hack for knowing if your citrus needs more water or not.
Yeah,
because if it's cool to the touch, and I often demonstrate that in community gardens, and it's like, oh, wow, you know, it's such a simple hack, and it basically lets you know whether it's dry or not.
Just last point, would you recommend something like sea mungus in the soil medium to start off with?
I would. And then once it gets growing, I mean, Ian actually talks about using that sort of stuff monthly, you know, slow release organic based pellets so that you're basically creating this smorgasbord that the plant takes what it wants when it wants it.
Lovely. All right then.
So, well, all the best with that, Rob.
See you later.
All the best.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, let us know if you do try the Ian Tolley method, how it goes.
It's quite shocking because, you know, we're used to bare-rooted plants in winter that are deciduous, but, you know, bare-rooting a plant in that's got leaves on it does feel counterintuitive, but the plants will thrive from it.
Great. Peter is in Glenelg with a ficus question. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
We're great,
great,
thanks.
Thank you.
Great. Look, yeah, I've got a ficus. It's been in a pot for about 7 or 8 years, about 5-6 foot tall. Just starting to drop its leaves quite severely over the last month, I suppose.
Okay.
It's called Midnight Beauty.
Beautiful. Can I ask two questions? Is this inside or on a veranda or?
It's on under the front eave of a house. Yeah.
Okay. Outside. Beautiful. And how often does it get watered?
Probably once or twice a week, a bit less in winter.
Okay. So the ficus actually can drop their leaves for two reasons. And typically with plants, it's either too much or too little. If they dry out, ficus are very quick to drop their leaves. And because it's a big plant in a small pot, I think it might be drying out. The other thing when you've got a plant that's been in a pot for a while is the soil tends to become non-wetting in the middle. So, you know, when you water it, the water runs over the top and around the sides and not into the centre of the pot. So the only other thing I'm going to get you to check is it's not standing in a saucer of water.
No.
And there's no chance that the bottom hole could be blocked?
No, it does run through the bottom when we water it. So
okay,
no.
Beautiful. Okay, so then I think it's drying out. All the soils become hydrophobic, so the water's not thoroughly wetting the root ball. So what I would tell you to do is to get hold of a soil wetter, and water it on, and then possibly pick the watering up because your plant has grown. And, you know, my rule of thumb with plants is you aim for watering them daily in pots, big plants particularly. And the thing is that if you miss daily, it's every 2 days. But if I say every 2 days and we miss it, then suddenly it's only, you know, once or twice a week. So pick the watering up and use a soil wetter and I think you'll be fine. I'd also then, because we know the plant's been under a bit of stress, I'd add some seaweed-based plant tonic and I'd also add some soluble fertiliser and it'll be fine. They are really hardy plants, but they are thirsty. They are basically subtropical plants, so they come from higher rainfall than what we have and the dry heat will cause them to dry out.
Yeah, it's producing new growth now. You know, they keep coming, but they just keep dropping, so...
The old leaves are dropping.
Black. They're black. They're quite glossy, but they've got a black striatum through them. So
have they got...
Look like a fungus.
Okay. Have they got... When you say black striation, can you tell me, if you were to wet your finger and wipe the leaf, does the black come off?
No, it's in...
No, it's not like a sooty mould. Okay.
No.
So, look, just try the soil wetter and watering more, Peter, and I'm sure you'll have success.
Thank you, Sophie.
Good luck.
All the best.
Yeah, hope it goes well, Peter, for a plant that's that old. You certainly want to keep it.
Sometimes, Deb, you know, if we go away for holidays and something dries out, you know, the follow-on from that, it sort of makes the root ball really dry and the follow-on from that can take a couple of months to show up.
Yeah, and that's the story of my life. Every time I take 2 weeks off, I have those issues. Sophie, just on the issue of touching a leaf, a couple of texts have come through on 0467922891 just asking clarifications. This person says, so if a citrus leaf is cool to touch, does that mean it needs water or not?
No. So you touch the leaf, you hold the citrus leaf in the middle of the day on a warm day, and if it's cool to the touch, it means it's hydrated. Because basically, if you think of a plant is like a giant evaporative air conditioning unit. You know, it draws moisture up through its leaves and breathes out cool, moist air. So the leaves, if they don't feel cool to the touch, the plant is dry. So it's a really simple hack for working out, you know, because people often go, oh, no, I'm sure I'm watering enough. And then you touch it and the plant isn't hydrated. Mm. Uh-huh. So now, obviously, a lot is dependent on the type of soil because the better your soil, the better it holds moisture in the soil. You know, if you've got sandy, gutless soil, it doesn't hold, moisture in there at all. But, yeah, so touch the leaf in the middle of the day on a warm day. And if it's cool to the touch, it's hydrated. And if it's not cool to the touch, you need to water it.
Okay. And someone else is asking, does the leaf touch test work for all plants?
Well, actually it does, really. you know, if you touch other fruit trees, you know, it's particularly beneficial for things like that, because if you touch it and it doesn't feel cool and it's in the sun, you know, it's needing water. Now, some plants are adapted to drying out. You know, if we talk about Australian native plants, you wouldn't worry about those, because if they're local Australian natives, they're designed to take it. But if it's fruiting trees and it dries out, you know, it might shed fruit. So that's where we want plants, fruiting plants, to be in optimal optimal condition, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of citrus, Tony in Glengowrie has a lemon tree not doing so well. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I put a new a lemon tree in last year in October sometime. It grew really well, had lovely green leaves, then it started fruiting and then it started going yellow. Has lots of these fruit flowers on there. I rang you in winter time and I got this special Ego seaweed pellet stuff, and I've sprayed on and everything else. I've put some chook feed around. I've put some blood and bone around. Still very yellow. It still had lots of more of these little flower fruit sort of buds coming. So it's still under stress and I don't know what to do now.
Okay, so bear in mind that citrus don't really like winter and it takes them a while to recover. So
yes.
We've really only had 1.5 months of warm weather for it to respond. So have you seen it green up a bit, Tony, or not?
The top leaves are staying green. A lot of the ones lower down, they're really yellow. It's been losing leaves.
And how often are you watering it?
Well, probably not enough.
I didn't hear this
segment about the
touching the leaves.
Yeah. So that's something I could do.
When you said leaves are dropping off, that's what made me think of you know, drying out. Now, the fact is you might have corrected the nutritional thing, but it's going to take a while to flow through to the plant if you put balanced organic fertilizer on. If the leaves are yellow with darker green veins, that can be lime-induced chlorosis. Sometimes you get it because, you know, we're on Adelaide soils tend to be alkaline. You know, if you've used something like mushroom compost, that can be alkaline.
Okay.
But I would just hold your ground for another month. You know, don't panic too much. Pick the watering up and all that nutrition you put on, see if the plant's looking better at the end of a month, because they're never going to respond over winter. You know, August, July, August is way too cold for them to show any benefit. And so keep the water up to it. And, you know, the subsoil, I don't know about where you are, but a number of people I'm hearing that the subsoil moisture just isn't there. You know, we had last year was the driest year on record. And this year, while we've had rain, it still feels like the subsoil moisture isn't there. So you've got to provide that for your plant. So pick the watering up and just watch it over the next month. Tony?
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
All the best.
Thank you for calling 1300 222 891. Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson with you, Talkback Gardening this morning. If you haven't won anything from the ABC in the last month and you'd like to win yourself one of our ABC gardening magazines, then you can phone through on 1300 222 891 or you can send your full name and postal address by text to 0467 922 891. We've got a couple of magazines to give away.
This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
David in Blakiston joins us. Good morning, David.
Hello.
Now, what tree have you got and what's the question?
I've got an Illawarra red tree. We planted as a young tree and it bloomed for the first time this year.
Oh, how exciting.
It was. Stunning looking tree, but at the moment it's a deciduous tree and the leaves are coming out, but it's got these big black, I reckon they're about 6 inches long, full, though I assume they're full of seeds, look like sweet corn in them. Should I cut them off or just let them drop?
You know, I'd just let them do their thing. How big's your tree, David?
It would be 20 to 30 feet.
Oh, okay. Definitely let them do their things. If you drive around and you see the Illawarra flame tree, you know, as street trees, because there are a couple around the place, you know, they've got their pods on them, and they're big black pods. They're quite significant in size, but just let it do its thing. And how amazing to have planted a tree. And how old is it?
It would be about, I don't know, 10 to 12 years old.
Fantastic. Awesome. Well, so no, I just leave them on there. You know, you don't want to be trimming anything. You know,
the bloody thing, you know, the ones down low are pretty easy to get to, but the ones up high, I'd have to get a ladder or something.
No ladders. So the reality is that is part of the process. You know, there's many trees we grow, whether it's gladiators or whatever, that have all these big pods, and you don't want to be cutting them off because you're just making work for yourself. So enjoy the flowers when they come.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. It's always nice to get that advice, isn't it? Do nothing. It's very handy. Michael's called in from Broken Hill with a cherry tree question. Hi, Michael.
Hello there, Deb and Sophie. How are you going?
Great, thank you.
That's all right.
How can we help you?
I'm in a bit of a quandary at the moment. I've got a Stella cherry tree. It's in a large pot.
Mm-hmm.
There is a heck of a lot of growth at the base of it.
Yep.
I don't know whether I should be trimming that off and getting rid of it or...
Okay. So has it got leaves at the top too?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. So the growth at the base, Stella is a grafted cherry tree. Well, as most fruit trees are grafted. So you need to find the graft on the stem. Usually it will be up about, 4 inches or, 10 centimetres. You need to find the graft, and if any of those shoots are coming from below the graft, you need to get rid of them. But you do not want to cut them, because when you cut, that means that growth is suckers. When you cut a sucker, it makes it more vigorous and it makes it bush up. So what you have to do is you have to make sure that the soil in the pot is really moist, and then you grab hold of each one of those growths and rip them off. Now, when you rip them off, they pull off a bit of skin or a little bit of bark from where they were attached, and at that point, the wound will heal, right? Now, it sort of pulls off a heel of bark, different sort of heel, and then it will heal as in it will get better. If you cut them, they will simply come back with more vigor, and eventually they'll take over the tree. So... rip them off, and if there's a couple that break in the process, sometimes you can sort of mosey around in the soil and go down further and find them. If there's a couple that you don't get, well, when they come back, get them then. But definitely rip off that growth, because eventually if you leave all those suckers there, it will take goodness away from the tree.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm doing it as you speak. I'm doing it currently.
Yep, yeah. And obviously feed your plant and just keep an eye on it. And if anyone's listening and you have got suckers, if you can get to them when the plant's young and get rid of them and stop them coming, it makes a huge difference. So I've just planted a new orchard and, some of my trees I can see have got little grafts. So I've been out there, little suckers below the graft. So I've been out there ripping those suckers off.
That's great, Sophie. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. I don't think we've had someone that's actually put Sophie's advice on air into immediate effect. So congratulations on that. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. Good on you, Michael.
Now, Bev is in the Barossa. Probably our last question this morning. Your Caledonian marigolds aren't looking so good, Bev.
Good morning. No, I've got some self-seeding ones that every year for about the last 25 years have gone all over my garden, which are beautiful. But this year they seem to have, I think it looks like a rust. They have like little globules, little orange on the leaves. And I'm wondering what I should do, if I should just take them out or, I've never had it before and I'm just after some advice.
Okay. Bev, I'm just going to clarify. I think you have calendulas, okay, yes. Not Caledonian marigolds.
Oh,
okay,
yes.
People get marigolds and calendulas confused. Calendulas are the beautiful daisies, often orange, beautiful boss of golden yellow stamens, singles or doubles, but you can also get yellows. Is that what you've got?
Yes, I've got yellow and orange, and they self-seed.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're everywhere in my garden, and they're beautiful. But this year they seem to have, it looks like a rough...
It is. You are spot on. Now, can I tell you, ideally, I used to get rust on the calendulas in my previous property at Mount Barker. And basically, I'm not going to bother spraying it. Basically, I should have weeded them all out and not had any for a year or two, and that would break the cycle, okay? However...
Okay.
I thought the benefit they provided in terms of feeding all the beneficial bugs in my garden was more important than the cosmetic problem of rust, if that makes sense. It doesn't kill the plants. It's purely that it looks unsightly. And so I made a conscious decision not to worry about it. Now, you might say, well, look, I could actually stop growing them in this area and keep growing them elsewhere. And if you, break the cycle, if you stop growing them for a couple of years, you'll get rid of the rust in one area of the garden. But ultimately, it's more a cosmetic problem. It might be that your garden's got more shady and more moist and it used to be sunnier.
Maybe not. No, we're kind of out on the farm and they just self-seed and kind of grow everywhere under my apple tree in my garden everywhere, and I love it. But this year there's just certain spots where now the leaves are going green. It doesn't particularly worry me, but I thought maybe I should just clarify what it is.
It is rust and calendulas will get them. And so, if you've got certain areas, maybe you weed them all out of that area and get rid of them. But obviously you don't just weed them out and throw them on the ground because the rust spores are still there. So, you take them away somewhere completely different. But ultimately what you have got seeding in your garden is calendulas, and that is so important to bring in the beneficial bugs. So, that's probably why you have a healthy garden with a good balance of ladybirds and lacewings and hoverflies.
No, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in, Bev, and thank you to all of our callers and texters this morning. Just on the issue of the Illawarra flame tree, Louisa sent through a text, Sophie, saying the big black seed pods are highly toxic to dogs. Not sure about cats, but to be sure, we remove lower ones or drop ones if you have a dog. And Louisa's dog loves the crunchiness, so they try and do that. So,
get rid of those.
congratulations to our magazine winners, Renee in Happy Valley and Lois in Pinthari. I don't know if I've said that correctly or not, but thank you very much for winning those magazines. Trudy in Auburn says this on the text line to you, Sophie. My citrus trees, two lemons, one orange, one lime, nearly died 2 years ago. They were young trees and two black frosts hit them hard and had a generally hard winter. At this stage, they are outside with no protection. I surrounded them in plastic over the winter after seeing a video of Sophie doing this to her trees in the Adelaide Hills, and they thrived through the last winter and already smothered in flowers and ready to fruit. I don't water a lot as I'm off-grid, but I do have heavy clay. Trudy, that's a great success story. There you go.
Absolutely.
We've got some happy tomato growers. John in Moana has sent through a beautiful picture of 3-year-old Oscar planting out the tomatoes. Says Oscar has had a hand in every step, from seeds to planting up the seedlings and now getting them into the ground. Shout out to Oscar. That's lovely. Thank you, John. And Trevor says, I've got a Tommy Toe tomato 1 metre high in a 40-centimetre pot with fruit setting and a little Sicily with fruit setting as well. Trevor gives us a smiley emoji there. Thank you. And just a word of warning from Megsy on Highway 1. We camped near Nundroo on the far west coast of South Australia overnight, and we have had thunder, lightning and a good inch of rain. Enjoy what's coming, Adelaide, she says.
Oh, beautiful.
Oh, wonderful. Well, look, Sophie, I hope you enjoy the Kwandong Festival in Quorn. I know it's a beautiful time to be there, and hopefully lots of people coming along.
I'm just here.
You're just hanging around and having a chat.
I'm chatting to everyone, and I'll be facilitating both days, today and tomorrow. And there are amazing talks. There are demos. We've got Andrew Filkey up here, you know, cooking up a storm tonight and doing cooking demos today. So it's going to be a fantastic weekend. And I love this part of the world. It's spectacular.
Wonderful. Now, you are not with us next Saturday. We've got Brett Draper stepping in for you.
Absolutely.
Well, Sophie, have a great time in Quorn.
Thank you. Happy gardening to all our listeners.